After chewing.
Oh, good. So, hello, everybody out there. This is a little special edition of Song News Network Presents with me and Paula DeAngelis from Australia. I'm not from, I'm in Portland, Oregon. She's in Australia. And we're here with Emma's Revolution, who consists of Pat Humphreys and Sandy Opitau, who are together are two of Paula and I. I don't know what the grammatical way to phrase it, but two of our favorite musicians.
Yes.
Yeah. I always get stuck with those prepositional phrases.
And contributors. And, they're contributors to the Song News Network collection.
They are indeed contributors to the collection. Yes. And so this is going out, by the way, on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance, as well as on YouTube, Twitter, and various other platforms. And it gets turned into a podcast later if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. So there's your little little directional non-commercial notification. Yeah. So,
it'll also be on the Song News Network YouTube channel.
Ah, good.
And probably Facebook
and I
as well.
Just pressed the button, which is what I was doing, so that it'll be on our Facebook page now.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, so
oh, fancy.
There you go. So
fancy.
We're everywhere.
Yeah, people can click share if you're looking on some platform. You know, I always forget to mention that to people. I always figure they can do
oh,
that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
share
so.
Share us widely.
The beginning of any interview is always where I get stuck because there's way too many questions, especially right now. Like, oh my God, they just discovered a vaccine and then Biden apparently is the new president. And it's like, I don't know what, and then we've been living through a pandemic. But one thing I don't know, you guys are doing such an amazing job at doing music and workshops and networking during the pandemic online. Definitely, I'd say in Paula and my worlds, we're continually impressed at the output and at how you're doing all this networking. And it seems like I don't know. I didn't even formulate a question on that subject, but I wonder if you could talk about how it's been to be you guys tour. You've been touring for many, many years. I've known you many, many years, and you guys tour pretty much as I do, I think. And it suddenly the whole world came crashing down, and all our tours got canceled. Yeah. And then it seems like you guys were just up and running right away with the whole sort of new Zoom reality, playing at Unitarian churches around the country every Sunday on Zoom, and all kinds of cool stuff. And I just wonder if you could start by talking about that wild transition among the many wild transitions that I think we've all had to make as working performers over the past 20 years in this constantly changing world.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had that same panic that you had, you know, within the course of about a week and a half, all of our gigs canceled. And I just thought we put it out on Facebook and just said, hey, we found ourselves with no work whatsoever. So anything that you could do to support us, we want to work. You know, we'd love to be working through this time, and we're going to figure out how to do that. And then Sandy just like jumped right on the technology end of it.
Well, I think that I want to sort of say a couple things around that. I got very lucky. So it might have been from that kind of Facebook post, but a friend of ours on Facebook said, hey, you should check out this group called Windborn, who are maybe they're in their 30s or something like that. And we were talking a little bit backstage that generationally they're
younger than we are by a fair bit.
There's a technological advantage generationally that those of us who might not be of that generation have to connect with people who are. So really our friend Lee, said, you should check out Windborn. They just did this great concert online. And I literally called Jeremy up from Windborn, or I texted him and Facebook messaged him. So, and he was just super willing to help us figure out how to do that, those very early Facebook Live events. And I think that when even just bringing in that whole sort of discussion of what has been crazy about this time, it sort of draws into why we do what we do and why we wanted to find a way to continue to do what we do. Because as activist musicians like you, David, like our world is about creating community wherever we were through song and through these concerts and stuff like that. And so I kind of had to rely on that. And the way Pat was saying, posting something, and we just got help from, you know, like somebody like Jeremy who wanted to explain it. And we were very lucky that we had a Patreon page set up in January. And it took us, you know, it took us a number of years of people saying to us, you should really, you know, yes, you're kicking your ass.
Get a Patreon.
That's a funny, that you just set up your Patreon account last January, just before the pandemic hit.
It took me years to like do all the, you know, get around the whatever, the logistical and brain sort of obstacles I had to get around and then come up with, you know, it's like everything we do as artists, we have to come up with the whole package, like the story, the song, the images, the whatever. So we had just done that in January and a few people responded. And then when the country got it and the whole world got it about what this meant for musicians and for artists of all kinds, then people were just on board right away. And we can tell you that having, you know, essentially having like a basic monthly income, like Andrew Yang talked about, changes one's life. I mean, we spent 19 years
traveling. Universal basic income.
Yeah. We spent 19 years touring and not having anything stable. And 19 years of instability is challenging. And we were certainly not the people who were suffering the most in this world, but it was very challenging to have that much instability, financial instability, and everything that goes on top of that. So having our community step up and want to donate, like whatever they're donating, starting with a dollar a month, it all makes a difference. And we totally encourage people to do the same. I know you had a program like that off of Patreon for a while, David.
Yeah, I set it up on my own website and then later set it up on Patreon. And I don't know why I waited so long to do it also on Patreon, because there's a lot of people, as I'm sure you've discovered, who actually just are into Patreon because it's like a really well-designed platform. And why make them work by going to some platform like my own website? Yeah. You know, I don't know what I was thinking, but you know, how much income I lost from not being on Patreon. I mean, I really hate to think about all that.
I wasn't bringing it up for that, but just to say that you were in the position that we were, which is like, make it up. And we always, when we did CDs, we had to essentially create a Patreon, like do a fundraiser kind of campaign in order to raise money to do CDs. So the whole Patreon thing is amazing. And it just started from there, that help from that Jeremy from Winborn got us. And then just thinking about, well, what can we do online? And we decided to, certainly we did some of those early Facebook Live concerts, which were fun and were not as unrewarding as I think some people think, because just seeing people's names fly by on the comments and then the hearts and the loves and the laughing faces, like it was very direct, and it has continued to be that way. I never felt like, you know, we were just performing to ourselves on screen. Never felt like that. It was very easy to still feel like I could see those people in a room. I could hear them singing along because we've done it for 19 years, you know, and just trusting that connection.
One of the really cool things about it I discovered is that when you're playing on different groups, Facebook pages or wherever you're performing, you actually get a geographically specific audience of those people. And then it's kind of like a little bit like doing a concert for them, really.
Yeah. Isn't it funny that people are still regional about those things? Like we do a concert based in Massachusetts and, you know, more Massachusettsites show up. It's adorable. It's kind of like human. I love the human element of that.
Yeah, we didn't know if that would be the case or not. But in fact, some friends of ours, Peter Blood and Annie Patterson, the folks who created Rise Up Singing and Rise Again songbooks, were doing very targeted concerts to get out the vote, and asked us to come along. And we were like, you know, what's this targeted thing? They're going to be anybody from any place is going to show up anyway. And we really saw that, you know, when they did a show for a Pennsylvania audience, a Pennsylvania audience showed up. When they did a show for a Florida audience showed up. It was really, really interesting.
Yeah.
I had not anticipated that at all.
I hadn't either. It had still taking me a while to get my head around, but to some extent, I understand if it's a venue, because the venue more likely the people right. that like the page is, are going to be local people who've heard of the venue. So then when you're playing on the Facebook page of the venue, it's, you know, yeah, oddly like playing at the venue.
But. Yeah. I think that's one way that people are keeping that feeling of connection yeah. is really not completely always doing internationally possible things, because they still want to do things that feel like home, like their congregation, because we do a lot of stuff with Unitarian Universalists, or, you know, with whatever whatever is their local theater group that's putting on something. So I think it's kind of a nice thing.
Yeah, I mean, they're maintaining their community connections, but they're also expanding their community connections. I mean, that's the other interesting side of this, is that we actually have people that are tuning in from around the world and now know about us, you know, which we never really had. You've always
like
been really good.
Right
yeah.
There.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. But you've always been really good at, you know, touring around the world. And yes. I could never like figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
You know,
but with the internet, yeah, definitely. Yeah. When everybody's stuck at home and they're not going to live shows anyway, then there's because I mean, I never got into the live streaming thing until just the past few months, because I was first of all always frustrated by the sound quality, which I've only just recently figured out how to deal with. But also, it just seemed like, okay, well, there's already too much free music everywhere, so I don't want to just add more pile of dung to the pile. You know, just seems like there should be something special about it if it's live. But I know that's something I was wondering about, because it's something we've all been struggling with for so long and in right. so many different forms. And like, I think of this industry, the music industry, to the extent that it's an industry, it's been in a state of continual collapse for about 25 years in just a new form of collapse every few years. Just when you think you understand the nature of the collapse, it starts collapsing in a new way. Like, I mean, to me, like the really seminal moment was when Spotify started their free tier.
Oh my God.
Like, because for me, I don't know about if it was the same for you, and I'm curious, but for me at the early stages of everything being free online, it was like, if I was giving it away on purpose by myself, the whole impact was totally different. People didn't pirate it. You know, they still bought CDs and they didn't pirate my music. But the big artists were getting pirated all the time, because I think in the popular imagination, they didn't need the money. Whether that's mm-hmm. true or not is another matter. But right. then it was 2013 when Spotify started their free tier, suddenly CD sales completely collapsed for me. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, like, that's also, so then what's kind of like for some of us, I think for you as well, that you were already thinking in terms of how do we change the way we're doing things in terms of crowdfunding or in terms of coming up with kind of a stable income, or is that something you didn't really start?
You can get so much more credit.
Right. No. You only started dealing with that whole question of like crowdfunding and Patreon and stuff just last year.
No, right? I mean, we always crowdfunded for CDs.
We always
produce a CD, we did a crowdfunding, or when we traveled to Palestine, we did a fundraising.
Yeah.
But for the rest of survival, because of course, you know, as I'm always telling people, that you it wasn't just about crowdfunding for the CD or making this money for recording the CD. The CD, you lived off of that for like the next year, mm-hmm. right? You mm-hmm. traveled around, you'd sell thousands of them in a given year. And that's a lot of money. That's a lot of profit. If, you know, even if you spend $5,000 or $10,000 on a recording, you used to still make money, right? Mm-hmm. On that, which that whole model just completely fell apart. And then even if you crowdfund for the CD, you're still like, okay, well, where's the food and rent coming from?
Right. I mean, the only similar thing that I think we did always think ahead about and always pass on whenever we had these conversations with people about how to do this work is that if you're booked for a gig, you should get paid half up front, because you got to make it till that gig. So you got to guarantee you get paid half up front. You do the gig, you get paid the other half, because there's all that time that we're still doing all the work of coordinating, whatever, buying the airline tickets, you know, promoting, and we did need money to get to through that time to get to the next gig. So that was kind of our way of trying to keep it rolling, plus credit cards, which is not
credit cards. Yeah.
yeah, that's real. I, you know, I started doing that actually when I was working solo, because, you know, I was really naive. I used to do so many things just sort of on trust and everything. And I showed up to gigs occasionally to find that they were not happening.
Yeah.
there was no crowd, there was no money, then there I was. So I was like, okay, from here on out, it's 50% of the guarantee down, and there will be a guarantee. Yeah. You know, I mean, I just had to get smarter and more professional and more, you know, oriented toward that end of the business, which I'm not particularly good at, but, you know, necessity, whatever. I figured out how to at least figure out some of the basics of that out of just the need to survive. And to tell you the truth, I mean, when Santa and I first started, first got together and started contemplating performing together, I just said, you know, I'm fried. I don't think I can do this anymore. Cause you know, I've been trying to make my living at this since the '80s. And, I just was never very good at the administrative end of it, to be honest. And I just thought, you know, maybe I'm just not cut out to do this sort of thing. And Sam came on and she said, you know, let's just give it a try. Like, here we are.
We had written
right? songs, you know, and we were writing a lot of material. So she was like, let's just give it a try. And here we are.
Yeah.
That's great to have somebody who's good at that kind of thing, right? Because ultimately, no matter how, I mean, I think you're such an amazing songwriter, but no matter how good you are, you just, you have to be good at marketing yourself, at least to some extent. Otherwise, it doesn't work, right? But in the 80s, you actually were in one of these artists who was, I believe, on independent record labels, which is a thing that maybe people don't realize it used to exist. But were you ever on Flying Fish or any of those?
No, I wasn't. I was on. No, I wasn't, actually. I approached all of those.
Oh, my goodness. And they didn't sign you. None of them.
Mm-mm. No, because, you know, it was right at that time when the industry and I was mostly in the folk music, more solidly in the folk music world in that time, the industry was moving from one of a whole bunch of small independent labels that were putting out a lot of traditional music and things like that in the folk world, and the whole singer-songwriter thing was just beginning. And, you know, I had people say to me on the phone, you know, we like your songs. We really like your songs a lot. We think you're a really good writer, but we're not sure whether this singer-songwriter thing is going to work or not. And we don't want to take any chances on alienating any of our audience by putting out things that might be controversial. So, mm-hmm. you know, I was like right at the, you know, that intersection.
And then I know I've heard you. I mean, this that you'd be too controversial.
And that third axis is the queerness.
But I think the truth is, you know, the controversial under controversial fell. You know, the fact that you're a lesbian is kind of problematic for some of our audience. You know, because our folk music audience has like a lot of different segments of the society was drifting pretty far right and has continued, I think, to do that.
Yeah. But then at the same time, in the 80s, there was this really fairly large scale phenomenon still I don't know if the term, I guess they were still using the term women's music, right? And which seems like such a bizarre dated term, but that's what they were talking about, right? And there were women's music festivals, right? Is that term still used? Women's music?
Yeah.
I mean now that I'm saying it sounds so strange, but I guess it's the word. So
it is kind of, but the, you know, the, we were also, well, I was at this intersection point with that, because they had started out with a bunch of women playing guitars, you know, and sort of folky-ish stuff, and then moved more into, stylistically, more into sort of a little bit more of a pop music thing. And they were really moving as fast as they could away from anything that sounded too acoustic or associated them too much with the folk world. And I fell right on the line there. You know, I was way too, you know, men would come to my concerts, and that was really alarming to some of the separatists during that time. I went through a period of time where I had to alternate in different cities that I played in, concerts that were open to all the audience and concerts that were strictly for women. I think a lot of it in my case just had to do with the particular time in our evolution as a culture.
Yeah, and what you were singing about and how you were crossing these bridges and how, yeah, that's a fascinating problem. I mean, because it didn't just work itself out depending on the venue. Like, you actually had to think about, okay, is this going to be a both gender or multi-gender or only for women? But like, because the venues, I would imagine, would kind of like sort that out for you. I mean, because they'd be a bit,
it depended. Yeah.
Can we talk about the time
about economics and all those things that, you know, stuff that affected all of us? I was talking about race and, you know, they were like, well, you know, we want you to talk about women's stuff. And I was like, aren't I?
Right. Aren't these things all related in a really obvious way?
And likewise, I would have the folk music community, you know, be like, well, why do you have to talk about being a lesbian? I'm like, because I think it's important. Because I think
it's part of the human experience.
Problems with this, wouldn't you agree? Why do you always have to talk about being lesbian? I'm like, I don't know, but I get this sense that it matters.
I don't know if Paula wants to interject with any questions, please do. But I was wondering about if you could talk about the time that you got played on National Public Radio, because that was a moment I remember. It was like a seminal moment in my life. I was like, whoa, look at that. Pat is on the radio.
Sweet. I want to hear that story. Yeah, absolutely.
I wrote this song called Swimming to the Other Side. And it's a song that people just picked up and sang much to my surprise right away. And so
people love it. Everybody loves that song. Yeah, all the people in the workshop when we learned it, you know. Yeah.
Australians were really pissed off about it. They were like, what about the Southern Cross? And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. It happens to be the stars I live under. Yeah.
I didn't even know what the Southern Cross was until I got to Australia. And finally, all those songs made sense. Like, oh my goodness, there's a whole genre about this constellation. I always figured you were talking about something burning in Alabama. And I was like, vaguely uncomfortable. And I don't know what this is about, but I'm just going to pretend that somebody else understands. And now it's all just sorted out. It was like instantaneous look up one night, like, okay.
We're very provincial over here in this country. Don't worry about it.
Well, because actually in some, that song followed not too long after Keep On Moving Forward was gaining, another was getting a little bit of notoriety in Australia because of Judy Small.
She was singing that song.
Recording that song, so then the Australians were like, who is this woman? Anyway, I wrote that song and it got passed around a lot. And then Marika Partridge, who she was at NPR and in the pretty early days, when she had started an NPR station up in Sitka, Alaska, where she lived. And so she had been like, just one of the names you heard all the time there. Well, she left NPR, but she continued to do some stories, freelance. And she and her family loved to sing. And they were at this family camp in West Virginia. And a couple of sisters, Lila and Ellie Grace, sang the song. They grew up in Missouri. I had no idea how they learned the song, but Lila had a radio show in the college town that they lived in. And so she found some of my music through that. So they had sung the song. Marika and her family just latched onto the song right away. They sang it all the way home. They learned it immediately. And she figured, there must be some big media campaign behind this song, because it seems, she started asking around about it because they really loved it. And everybody she talked to knew the song. So she fully expected that, there was some big, New York PR company promoting it or something. And she found out that it really had just traveled by word of mouth, and that intrigued her. So she decided to do a story for All Things Considered about it. And we had been talking about getting together, and she actually found me when Sandy and I were still living in New York. We had just gotten together, and we were I had plans to move down to Maryland. So I was like, I'm going to be moving you up for this. And Marika called, and I don't remember who answered the phone because I don't.
No, I answered the phone because I didn't know her name. And I was like, I like put my hand over there. I was like, Pat, there's someone named Marika Partridge who wants to talk to you. And I, you know, like I didn't know her name.
And I was like, Marika Partridge is calling me? What? You know, because I had listened a lot to NPR and I heard her every single time I, you know, tuned in. And I thought, why is Marika Partridge calling me? And then she told me the story about hearing the song. And she said, so, you know, she was sort of like, who are you? And I said, well, and then she said, you know, I live in the DC area. I live in Tacoma Park. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. We're moving down to the next county over to where you are in a couple of weeks. And she was like, you're coming here? Yeah. So we had this plan to meet up. And we were on our way, you know, packing and everything. And September 11th happened. Mm. And we were actually in the neighborhood at the time, down there in Maryland. And then, of course, everything turned to the coming war and all this stuff. And so, you know, I was like, yeah, Marika, I don't know when I'm going to have time. We're going out on tour. And we just took off, you know, and traveled as much as we could. We were singing, you know, we had just written Peace, Shalom, Shalom, and doing a lot of demonstrations. And, you know, we were in New York for that first big peace rally and sang there. And so I frankly thought, this interview is never going to happen. And then Marika called up and she said, I want you to come to my house and do a house concert. And then I want to interview you because I really think this is an important story. And I was like, okay. And so we went there and we did a really lovely house concert. And then I think it was the next day.
It was January.
That was January. That. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then we did the interview. But then the war broke out and everything, you know, I mean, war really heated up. And again, I just thought, this is never going to happen, you know? And it took a long time, really, for it didn't air until May. Mm. And even then, you know, there were so many things going on in the news. I just thought this is never going to rise to the surface. And they had asked that. I don't know exactly the terms that she used, but something along the lines of, do you know anybody famous? You know? And I was like, well, I know Pete Seeger. And I did a lot of work in the Hudson Valley with Clearwater and stuff. And, you know, he might be willing to be interviewed about it. I don't really know. Like, we don't usually do business stuff. You know, we just kind of stayed away from that stuff mostly. But she called him up and he was willing to give her an interview. And that was, and I think the song just fell at a moment when people really needed some sense of hope and some sense that things were going to get better somehow. You know, New York City was so, so, so traumatized in so many places. Really, around the world, we're so traumatized by the war. Places around the world, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq. So, I think the combination of things, just that confluence, made
that
it.
That timing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
and the song, and the simplicity, and the message, and the story, and But also that's so interesting just from a industry standpoint, because I know how many stories on NPR almost happen but don't happen, which is most of them. Mm-hmm. And that's the fact that they needed to know, do you know somebody famous, and that they needed to basically have that conversation with Pete Seeger as part of the thing. Otherwise, it might not have flown according to their producers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but then when it did, can you talk about the results of that?
Let me say for the first part of when it flew, which is that when it finally aired, like we knew it was going to air on that, you know, I think it was a Wednesday, May 22nd in 2002.
I was playing at a protest that day. I remember there was one in DC that there was an anti-war protest, I believe.
We were on the road between New York and DC, and we knew what time, you know, it was going to be on All Things Considered. And so we were going to be driving on that time, like between, you know, New York and DC. And Pat was like, you're going to listen to NPR while you're driving and you're going to be on NPR. She's like, I always listen to NPR when I'm driving. I'm like, not when you're on it. Pull over. And so we like stopped at one of those rest stops on the New Jersey Turnpike. So I'm like, you can't be driving while you're like listening to this thing. And just you gotta listen to you.
It's like, casual. I'm on NPR every day.
So it was actually pretty sweet. And we heard from so many stories from other people who were like, especially, you know, people who stayed in their cars because they started to hear the story and they had gotten to their destination, but they wanted to listen to it. And especially there was this one woman who wrote and said that she was in a cab and she was, you know, and the story was on and they got to her destination and she and the cab driver were both like, he turned off the meter. They both wanted to hear the end of the story together. I just thought that was so lovely, you know, so the response included really sweet personal emails that we got of like stories of people listening to it. You know, the only place they could get the station was going to be in their car. So they knew it was going to be on, they drove, you know, to hear it. It was amazing.
Yeah. Pretty much all five of my sisters had to listen to it in the car because they don't have reception in their houses or they didn't. We got thousands of emails, you know,
And
a friend had our friend
Lee, the same one who got us hooked up online. I mean, she's just our goddess of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. She had put up a website for Pat a week before.
it was just in time.
Great, just in time. And the website included a merch store, did it?
It did.
Where they could buy CDs. Excellent.
And people bought so many CDs. It was amazing. We had to have a work party like with our friends and neighbors who came and just like filling up the living room, be like, people, you put them in the envelope, you weigh them, you stamp them. You know, it was like, it was nutty. And it was also beautiful. Oh, the best thing was when we got to the post office in our town after we arrived home, you know, and like whatever, a few days later. And they were like, I don't remember how they knew it, but they were like, are you 244? Are you 244?
Box 244. We were like,
here. They were like, give us a card.
They had a crate.
We got several of those. We got letters from people. We got orders because some people didn't do like the PayPal thing and stuff. So they did it by mail. And, you know, so it was really amazing. I mean, from that time on, you know, every year we would take a big basket of stuff to the postal workers.
Yeah, they were so appreciated. It was
much work they did for us.
And we still love postal workers. And they should get their autonomy back.
Absolutely.
And DeJoy should be out on his ass like of all of those people. Yeah.
The other really funny thing about there are a number of things that happened. I got another phone call and I'm going to forget the name of the guy now who was the head of
Red House
Records called me up before the thing. He said, you know, I'm getting calls from people at NPR saying that they want to make sure that we have enough stock on
Excellent.
Hand.
Excellent.
Because that I was with Appleseed Recordings.
Oh, good. So you did. They did. Appleseed sign you. That's nice.
I was with Appleseed, and my second solo CD, Hands, came out on Appleseed. But that was the only, you know, record company experience I had. But they were calling the parent, you know, the head of the parent company, saying, you know, we got to make sure that there's that you have enough, you know, merch in,
yeah,
in reserve. Awesome. And, you know, he said, you know, I've had all kinds of people on this label who had NPR stories. And, you know, I just, we thought it was going to be a really big thing and it wasn't. And so I don't know what to think about this. And I said, well, okay, they just keep telling me that they're not going to release it until they know that there's a certain amount available there. So I'm
just, that's what they were telling you at NPR?
Yeah. So I'm just telling you what they told me, and I have no idea whether this will go or not, you know? And then it did. It was amazing. You know, we were just shocked, and we were trying to buy a house at the time. And the, you know, the bank, they never openly laughed, but they, you know, we were like two independent songwriters, self-employed people. They were like, yeah, sure. You know, come back when you get a job, girls. I mean, we really, you know, but we could actually, I took a screenshot of our merch page, and we got our mortgage within a week.
Oh, yeah, great.
Yeah. That was like the start. It was like big start, you know, and that was
right,
good.
Right. Because we had just moved to Maryland. We're like, well, we can see that you can make a living in New York, but we don't know that you can make a living in Maryland. And we were like, will this help? You know? So that was amazing. But
so
the
that
other
was a
thing
good launching moment and
was yeah. that we were, what was his name? The artist that just released a CD and he was
Eminem.
I'm just forget right. Eminem had just released that day. His new CD had dropped. And he was announcing this big world tour and everything. This is the second call that I got from the head of Red House Records. And he said, you're number one on Amazon. And I was like,
oh my God.
Oh, so like in the little folk thing, right? You know, because they didn't sell a whole lot of CDs there, I'm sure. You know, and he was like, no, overall, you are number one on Amazon. And I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? So for 3 days, we were number one in sales on Amazon, and we were outselling. See, I'm still forgetting his name.
Eminem.
Don't forget Eminem's name.
That is like a blip in people's history, people, and we should celebrate it because for 3 days, this out lesbian woman outsold that hater, right? I don't remember if he's crossed the line past and has you know, sort of become not.
And you know something? Eminem would love that.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Well, yeah, so I mean, like amazing things have happened, you know, like that. And I used to joke and say, so it was like an 8-minute segment. So I would used to joke on stage, like, you know, Pat had 8 minutes of fame and she has 7 coming to her and I still have my complete 15. So it's like that's, you know, that was an incredibly huge moment in 30 years before of that for you or 20 years before for your career. I mean, you've been doing this for as long as you were, you know, since you were a teenager. And so it's one of those things. And actually I remember David one time in our newsletter, we sort of said something about how we had this, you know, NPR, you know, thing, and it was, and you were like, that was 10 years ago. Like you're still talking about that. That was it. That was all we had. We had people to
gonna,
talk about it.
You said something like, people are going to think that, you know, you've never had anything since. We're like, because we haven't.
only a songwriter could put that out to us. Like, it was so great. It was so perfect. I was like,
I'm so sorry.
It was fantastic. It gave us an opportunity to really laugh and be like, God, is that what we look like? But you know, it was a victory. It was a people's victory. It was like a victory for someone who's been writing songs that become songs that people sing around the world. And I think it also, it sort of just points to people power because we've been able to do this and much more stably now because of people power, because we are community supported art now in the best sense of the word. And even in that moment, what that meant was that NPR was sort of delivering something to people that they didn't know that they would respond to and that they didn't know that they would love, you know, because they weren't gonna find that kind of message every day on mm-hmm. commercial radio or even on public radio. And so we really do feel like it's a people's victory. And that's just what we've had to have a lot of blind trust in that. And I think that's why it's sort of come back to us now during pandemic land, like people got it. Oh yeah, this music meant something to me or still means something to me. And there's nothing there now. And so they had to really become it for us. And it's been amazing.
Were there particular, any particular sort of ripple effects from that, that you're still kind of noticing now and then? Like, I mean, from people signing up on Patreon or messages that you get from people, is it still kind of like rippling in a noticeable way?
Correctly, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
For years and years.
Yeah, we don't hear so directly. But
Years and years we did. People were like, oh, I heard that song and, you know, 5 years ago and I still remember it. But I don't think directly so much. You think so, Paula?
I mean, we don't.
Well, when we learned the song in the workshop,
right,
there was a lot of people who said that the song had got them through some tough times,
right,
and Gail said that too, and I think this particular song, I think Swimming to the Other Side, the thing about it is it has a universal meaning that continues to resonate because it's about hope, and it's, you know, like you were saying, that was a kind of time of universal despair amongst all the leftists that you knew. They were all in a really dark place, mm-hmm. right? But we all go through that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think there's any radical out there who doesn't go through that despair at some point or another. Mm-hmm. And that song really speaks to getting you through that, mm-hmm. you know. So, yeah. And so, you know, Gail said Gail's been a fan of yours for a long time now, about as long as I have, because I discovered you back in the days when you had one downloadable album, and that was Revolutions Per Minute. And excellent. I went, I'm just gonna pay for that and download it, and then get my head around getting CDs from the US later on. And I passed it on to Gail as well, because she just bought an iPod, I think, or something like that, right? She wanted music on it. She said, put music on it for me, Paula. And that was one of the very first songs that she started singing along with when she decided to take up singing many years later. And it's because of that, you know, both of us have been through that. Yeah. And lots of people in there said that, and I think it's one of those songs. Like, you've had other songs take that story behind the piece Salam Shalom. That's really cool. Yeah.
That was the next song I wanted to mention, was that that one, how it took off. And
the one I really like is the one where you became K-pop stars.
We Are One.
I missed that.
Yeah, that's right.
Explain before we. I'm happy to talk about songs. That Paul is also referring to a weekly workshop, which is one of the things that we started doing in pandemic land, and we do it every Sunday. It's called Learn an Emma's Revolution Song, and it was
what got you to start doing that.
I think I needed to think about like what could we do, and we never succeeded in putting out a songbook with chords and all that kind of stuff. So this was our opportunity.
You haven't yet.
We had not yet, right. And so we just thought that, and we had people, you know, wanting a songbook and stuff like that. So I think that was really where I was thinking about with that one. And I wanted to say about pandemic time that actually workshops work amazingly well and surprisingly well. So that one we've been doing every Sunday at 1 p.m. Pacific for many, many weeks, and just going one by one through songs, whether they're classic songs that we've had for a long time or new songs that we write. And it's really possible both to sing together, even though we can't hear each other, but also to coach on guitar chords and to talk about songwriting a little bit. And we do, we have two songwriting sessions that we run a week, every week too. And when we started that first one, we just were like, how is that going to work? Because half of what we do when we do songwriting in a room is that, you know, we get people to sort of start these spontaneous songs and then they sing them out and everyone sings them back with harmony. And we felt like, how are we not going to be able to do that? And how is it going to is it going to work online? And it ends up that we can still do enough of that sort of supportive, we sort of sing it back to them for harmony. But the fact that everyone can turn the sound off on their little box and work on their song while we're talking with somebody else about their song actually ends up to be amazingly useful. So songwriting works online, which we didn't know it would do.
And the fact that there are two of us here too, you know, we can sing their you know, little idea of a melody. One of us can sing that melody and the other can sing the harmony. So we get some of that effect. And
yeah,
it has worked remarkably well.
How do you decide, and when you're doing the workshops, you're not just doing them for the general public, they're like invitation kind of thing in Zoom or some format. Like, how do you limit, how do you decide how many people should be in the workshop?
So the Learn and MS Revolution is a public thing. That's on Facebook. That's on Zoom and Facebook Live. And that could be any number of people because it isn't as specific as songwriting. But our songwriting, we really based it on who was interested. And we have had up to, I think we've had like almost 20 when it was at its biggest. And that was a little too big because it was just hard to fit having attention for everybody's song and going through the circle of people. I think we have something like 13 now in our bigger class or 14. It's
are we that big? I don't remember
something
quite
like that.
You know, somewhere between 9 and 14.
We wouldn't do
I don't
more
count
than,
anymore.
Yeah. We wouldn't do more than something like 15, I think, just for timing. Cause we spend like, it's like a 2-hour session and the other one is a smaller group and it's an hour and a half session.
One of the things that we asked folks to do is, even if they were experienced songwriters, to do our sort of intro, an intro session with us, just so they could understand how we go about songwriting, so that they would understand the kinds of things that we were asking them to do to help them generate ideas and stuff like that. And
we do an experiential kind of
thing. So it's a very organic, very experiential kind of thing. You know, neither of us, I mean, Sandy actually has a music education. I don't really have a lot of background in that. And I'm mostly,
but I don't
self-taught.
Fucking use it and don't make
it. Hey, you haven't put the songbook out yet, right?
So
you're not using it enough to make a songbook anyway. Yeah, huh?
Right, exactly.
There are programs that'll help you with this.
She does know the chords. Yeah.
I do know the chords.
I don't usually.
They do this thing where Pat goes, oh, is that the chord I was playing? I didn't know that. It just sounded right.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but I used to know the names of all my chords, and then I started playing with Dadgad. Now I have no idea what I'm doing.
Right.
I just like something.
And we always say that it doesn't matter because the music came before the words that describe the sound. So people were making music and creating sound and not bothering to put a term to it. So the terminology is all secondary.
I mean, it's helpful. Like in the studio when we were working with side musicians and stuff like that, and I mean, so when we are, it's helpful to have the language and all of that stuff. And, you know, I do wish that I knew more of that stuff, but thankfully I actually have Sandy who does speak that language. So that's good.
I'm just playing it up for the camera. I just can't resist. You know, I just like try to make you laugh. It's part of my job. You know.
It works.
It's an ongoing mission in life to make that laugh. Yeah. It's just the best love. We all like doing it.
Yeah, that's right. I sent Paula the laugh track, by the way. Right, Paula?
Oh, it's so cool.
So back in the days when we needed to do a campaign for a CD, one of the perks that we had for people if they donated a certain level was that they got this laugh track of Pat laughing.
It's like two minutes
like two
and 14
minutes
seconds or something
Pat.
Of me laughing. People would come up to us after a concert and they'd just be, you know, I could listen to a whole CD of you laughing.
Great. So that became your perk that you were just letting them have this track occasionally.
Yeah, that's such a
wonderful
fabulous
reward.
Oh my God. You got to be creative in this job, you know? So.
Definitely. Yeah. Wow. Got to come up with something unique. Yeah.
Right.
It's unique.
Yeah. So
one of those things about the, you know, the peace, salam, shalom song that always just wildly impressed me and as just such a mystical phenomenon was how that t-shirt just spread around the world. And I would be touring, I've toured in countries where I'm pretty sure you've never been, but that t-shirt is like around. Right? Somehow people get the t-shirt and they make their own versions of it. And they may or may know that there's a song related to it. It's really quite, it became such a meme, and it was
well, you know. And I have to say that
that's because of the lefty Mormons. Were they Mormons?
Oh, that,
yeah,
right.
That was later in the game,
yeah, actually. That was quite a bit later, yeah. Actually, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
That did happen, the lefty, yeah, Mormons. Yes.
Well, the idea of putting those three words together is not a new idea, and other people have certainly done that, and even I can't remember anybody's name these days.
Keep eating chocolate.
My blood sugar is low. Other folks have put those.
Donnelly Colt.
Yeah, Donnelly Colt put those words together. In fact, we had a long sort of uncomfortable conversation about that one time. But I just felt like it was really important to have those three words together and to have peace not in English, not be the first thing that people saw. I really wanted it to be the Arabic language first. And it also graphically, it just worked that way because we did the Arabic in the script and then the Hebrew in block letters. But we thought that it would be more recognizable that way too. But I just felt like we always put ourselves first in the US. We always put English language first. And this just felt like a moment where we need to stop doing that. And it was so interesting to see how strongly the Muslim community in DC responded to that, because we were by then living in the DC area. It was not lost on them that we put their language first. And, you know, people were terrorized so soon after all of that happened. The businesses, I mean, I'm sure you remember, but they really, really remember.
Yeah, after 9/11, and people people who wore turbans would have to have an American flag, like decal on their windows, because they didn't want to get harassed or attacked in their cars.
So yeah. I think that had something to do with it, that we did not put ourselves first in that lineup. And there are lots of, you know, we've been lots of places where someone will walk by in the shirt and be like, my shirt.
You know? And they don't know.
They don't know anything about us. They don't know anything about the song or anything.
It's kind of great.
You know, some food co-ops would carry it and stuff. Syracuse cultural workers, who are, you know, old buddies of ours from a million years ago, they started carrying it. And, you know, they've been sort of the merchants of materials for the left for a long, long time. So I think that helped spread the word. But, you know, again, it was just kind of a person to person, word of mouth sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, when you mentioned, I know this is only tangentially related, but when you mentioned how after 9/11, there was such an atmosphere of terror for Arab people in the U.S. But at the same time, as soon as 9/11 happened, I was fearing that there would be pogroms against Arabs. And then I was, I guess, at least somewhat happily surprised to hear George W. Bush saying Islam is a religion of peace and don't blame all the Muslims. And I mean, there was a lot of other horrible rhetoric coming out of the White House. But at that key moment, I just was, you know, with Trump, I was just imagining what possibly he would have been saying at the time, which would have been very different. I think. And in the all, there's been so many social movements that we've both been part of for decades now, and they come and go, and the size varies, and the militancy, and the politics, and the issues, and we all try to write songs about them and interface with them. But I wonder what your particular experiences have been with the movement that's been on the streets since the end of May. Has that been And I'm also curious about the Get the Vote Out campaign that you guys have been quite involved with. I know you mentioned it, but if you maybe any thoughts on how that seemed to go? Obviously, Biden seems to have been just barely elected, so that's it's, you know, hope maybe you got a couple hundred of those votes were from your efforts. I don't know. we never know about these things.
We have to hope, you know, that we did. And I think everything that everybody did was absolutely necessary, because as we saw, you know, Biden got more votes, which is great. It's really, really important. And the Electoral College has got to go, because that's the only reason why we were squeaking, you know, or biting our nails for 5 days is because of the Electoral College, which obviously is a relic and a dangerous relic and needs to go. And then we can see also how many people were still willing to vote for a disgusting, cheating, lying, hateful, killing president, or, you know, near president, pretend president. And maybe they were voting because they're complete racist, or maybe they were voting because they thought the economy means more than people's lives, which either way, it's a problem. And we have to, you know, reach out and figure out some way to change their minds. And I do feel like everything that all of us did, we needed absolutely every inch of that, which was, for, in our case, we wrote, you know, gonna vote your asses out. And we did our best to create a video that would be engaging for people and inspiring for people. And we got a lot of
lots of hits.
Yeah. And it was important to us because, you know, this is what we do. Like, this was a prime opportunity to do that and to support people in that. And for Black Lives Matter, I mean, we wrote a song that we were able to sing out into the world as much as possible, but we didn't want to be there singing in the streets, because that's a super spreading kind of event, even though people are now back to, you know, a super spreading activity of singing in a crowd. People are now back to it and chanting and whatever. But I'm a person who's, you know, at a risk for this disease, and so I really don't mess around with it. We did do a live demo this past week, which was part of the Protect the Results. So a live in-person, socially distanced, but that was our first one in this time. And so beyond that, we've been doing the work of supporting communities who, you know, so that I'm thinking, like, particularly of Unitarian Universalist communities. We sing a lot with Unitarian Universalist congregations and concerts and stuff, because they are a denomination that really values music and values social justice. And it's a great fit for us. And then we can be there as people who are very well-versed about what the being active on the streets feels like and what it can do for people and what edges we need to push for a community that may not be ready to push it to that degree. So we feel like we're doing some of the work so that it isn't all on the people in those circles to have to say, no, really, defund the police is important. And it's a concept that needs to be, you know, not just sort of like pushed away and be scared of. There are reasons why we're at that language. And the song that we wrote, you know, we just added that into what was possible for people to use and feel inspired by.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that we had already been doing as a practice, just because we felt like we have such a horrible, long, bloody history of institutional racism in this culture, that, you know, if there are any ways that we can undermine that system, we're happy to do that. So we've done whenever possible, invited our friends and loved ones of color to be part of our projects in any way we possibly can.
Yeah,
and
videos and recordings and,
you know, help
Reggie Harris.
You know, to help send work their way and bring them into our projects. And, you know, so I think putting out content that demonstrates the, you know, at least steps toward dismantling that, I think is, and, you know, there is no community that's getting this perfectly. You know, everybody's doing what they can from where they are. And some people, of course, are doing as much as they can to not deal with racism. And I think, you know, I think this election had so much to do with fear. I heard from an old classmate, and I've kind of given up on, you know, trying to connect with my classmates. I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and you know, though the county that I grew up in is the most populous county, and it's also the most Democratic county, it's still, you know, it has gone so far right in my lifetime. It's just shocking to me. And I heard from a classmate, and she, frankly, I was surprised that she bothered to read our newsletters anymore.
Yeah. Why was she on our list?
I was fairly horrified with her views on things. Yeah. I wasn't really reading her things at all. And she said to me after our last newsletter,
where we were celebrating.
Where we were like, phew, thank goodness. Yeah. Okay.
Thank goodness. You know, so that now we can do,
wasn't
the,
my first choice,
continue
but
to
all
do
right,
the work,
you know,
create the change, but
these
we
people,
this.
I think we can push, you yes. know, maybe, hopefully. Yes.
Somebody said, celebrate the loss, mourn the victory.
Yeah, this, you know, this is not a perfect solution by any stretch. I get it. I really get it, you know, but there's nobody to work with right now. So, okay. But she was like, you know, I draw the line at communism. And I was like, where did you,
where ever- do you get the communist from?
Getting, you're kidding me.
I know. God.
Oh, I know. My God. All the people are like, we're going to be getting socialism with me. Like, we are? This is great.
You know? I can't wait.
Anything would be better.
Please bring it on.
I'll take it.
How was doing your first gig with a sound system for what, 9 months or something? Was it really cathartic, or were you just worried about spreading COVID, or did you have a good time at the demo?
We had a lovely time. I mean, it was nice to see humans. It was great. And it also just wasn't like, it's not the same as doing a concert either, you know, demo and yeah. such. We were certainly glad to be there. And the sound was actually fantastic, which was amazing. There, you know, we know these organizers in San Francisco and they know us well enough. Like, I just said, well, you know, we have to think hard about coming out live. Like, what's the sound situation?
If we're going to be singing through a bullhorn, we're probably not going to make the hour and a half drive.
But, yeah. You know, real. We knew we're like, that crew? Okay. You know, that's great. Yeah. It was actually a really good crew. Good sound.
Excellent. It's, you know, because it's socially distanced and everybody's wearing masks and everything, it's not like the energy that we would usually feel.
And we wore masks.
In a live situation. And we sang through masks and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was very conscious of, you know, the two people who were not masked who were speaking into the mic. And I was like, you're going to fix that before we, right?
It's complicated.
Where's my sanitizer?
Yeah, they had people in the sound crew. They would wipe down the mic
each time and have little covers over it.
Really
and
good, you know, good. Right thing.
Different covers. Yeah, we can rotate the covers. That should do the trick, I imagine. I just bring my own mic because I can't deal with stuff. Terrible example, but I don't sing through the mask, so I bring my own mic.
It's very real. It's, you know, the threat is very real. Yeah. And you know what we're doing is just by definition a super spreading activity. Yeah. So I, you know, I'm really, really conscious of that.
Yeah.
I don't want to sing in a building for a long time.
No. Can't wait for this vaccine. Do you have anything in particular to add, Paula? Or
I've been able to sit here and not ask a single question because you've all just done it.
We get three scummers in the room, you know. We have
you're such a good storyteller, Pat. I think there's been a really good perspective. You know, I have my own perspective on.
Oh wow! That's perfect.
Technology.
Wow, what a place to freeze. Wait a sec, we lost you for a moment there. Can you? Yeah. Just, you have your own perspective on it. Was like the most pregnant pause imaginable. Fantastic. Really.
It was theater. We thought you did it
on purpose. I one of the things that has come out of doing the putting together the Song News Network collection for me has been this kind of, you know, part of it is about that whole notion of music, any kind of art being work. People don't realize that, you know, that and you know, that's part of what interests me is rendering that visible. But also, I think with musicians, what I find interesting is the way that it's always musicians who are kind of in the forefront of mastering a new technology and using it to do creative things and build the community and connect with their community. So, you know, that you've sort of given us a personal perspective on how you've done that in the latest, you know, in the new normal and in the past as well. And so that's been great. I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, I have like a million follow-up questions, but it might have to wait for another episode because we've gone over time.
I have a million follow-up questions too. It's so easy to spend another hour on just the follow-up questions to somebody's story, you know, and get even more geeky about it, you know. But this has been great. Thank you so much, both of you, all of you, for joining the discussion.
And I want to say thank you for saying that, Paula, in the way of making visible this work that we often feel is rather invisible. And I imagine that David can have that same feeling of it. Not that it's invisible, but it's intangible. And and this is a nice way to hear that reflected back, that part of what you're doing in Song News Network is to make it a little bit more tangible for people. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah. It's a personal obsession of mine as well. And David and I have been reading this book about this exact topic, and David's going to be interviewing the author. It's called The Death of the Artist.
Right.
And you guys should look it up. You'd really like it. Yeah.
Right.
Wow. You'll unquestionably find it cathartic reading.
Oh, good.
Yes. He's a journalist.
You'll be like, oh my God, there I am again.
Yes, that's exactly right. Because he's done a kind of Studs Terkel for the arts industry. So he's gone and interviewed a whole bunch of working musicians and put that all together in this great piece of journalism. It's really good.
Which is also full of statistics as well. Yeah.
Doesn't address the
state of the moment. Great work.
I feel like the pandemic made people realize. And does it address the pandemic and that because
No, but everything is just got everything he writes about has gotten like 20 times worse since the pandemic. But it was all written before the pandemic. Yeah.
It's interesting. Because one of the things that we found actually during this pandemic.
He told me.
Oh, sorry, you froze again there.
Oh, he's in the middle of writing an essay about the effect of the pandemic on the art.
Good.
We've talked about it, yeah.
One of the things that we found, actually, is that, you know, because we're not schlepping everywhere, because we're not, you know, doing all the logistics, doing all the booking in the same way and all that, we have more time to do music. It feels like you're actually doing more music now. Yeah. Than we have in the last 19 years or more, you know, and and while it's still work, it's, you know, we get to get up in the morning, open the door, sit down in front of the computer and do this stuff, or, you know, call our friends, have them record their part, send it into us. Sometimes we send it into an engineer for them to sort of clean up parts. And, you know, it's just a whole different thing. But the response has been really important because what we found is that our audience, more than ever, I mean, and we always had a really supportive audience.
Yes.
But more than ever, our audience has come out and just said, what can we do to support you? We realize even more now how much we value what you bring to us. You know, we have people that have been isolating since March, who've been alone since March, that come to our concerts so that they're not alone. I mean, that is really such important work. That we can do that we have the means to do that, and that people so much across the board get the value of that is just incredible.
Yeah, and people are really doing, you know, the people who can support us are then supporting us for the people who need the support, who need the musical support and the community support. So it's amazing. I mean, this is the most, you know, concrete for us that it's been and most stable time, which is bizarre. You know, it's sort of it's an indication of how upside down the pandemic is, but us we're lucky, and the stability, I'd be happy for it to stay for us, and we can also go back to being humans without the pandemic,
and we can play a concert for 100 people and then it goes up online, and you know, in the matter of a very short period of time, thousands of people have watched it. So it's, you know,
It's so good when you can make it work. But then when you read this book and you hear so many of the reports on NPR and elsewhere about all these artists, you realize that the vast majority of them never got the crowdfunding thing to work and never got it off the ground. And they're working one or two jobs, usually in the service sector, in order to make
it,
which have also dried up. So it's just a fascinating, just total clusterfuck for so many of And then some of us who managed with the crowdfunding were a whole different.
It's a universal crisis rather than a specific. If you're a musician, you're used to crises, right? You have them on an individual basis all the time. and same if you're in the industry at all. But this one, it happened to everybody all at once.
Not
just the musicians, but it happened to all of the tech people. All of those, you know, there's a whole huge crowd of people in Australia who make their living by working at music festivals. You know, setting up the sound or the marquees or the whatever. And that work just disappeared. All the festivals got cancelled. You know, it was across the whole industry all at once in many countries, you know.
Globally, that's the global thing. Is I always thought, as a, you mentioned, and I tour a lot in other countries, and you know, that I always thought, well, at least if the economy collapses in the US or something, or I have no more fans in the US, at least there's like England and Denmark, and Europe. Well, there goes the whole world all at once. It was really quite something. God. I diversified my assets and it still didn't help, you know?
Well, I have to say that while we have been talking to you about how supported we are, we know we're very unique, partly because we can do just with the two of us and not a musician. We know lots of people who are side musicians and that's not the same story for them. So we're very aware of that. And also just dancers and symphony players and, you know, on and on. So we're very aware that we are kind of lucky. And I think part of it, though, I do think, and I know we're doing follow-up questions into our next I do think that it makes a difference that we were always grassroots musicians and very connected to our audience directly. We stayed in their houses when we traveled. We had dinner with them before the show because they cooked it and brought it to the church where we were playing. So I think that
we know their kids. We've watched their kids grow up.
Right. You know? And so I think that that's that's partly why we are able to keep going, because we can still have that kind of direct connection. Whereas if you have a record label in between you and your audience, or you have a manager between you and your audience, or whatever it is, that we did not have anybody between us and our audience. So they still were with us.
And that's a lot of musicians have been using this time to make that direct connection with their audience again, because you know, as you said, it's you're working in the business, but you're also working on the business. Your real work is writing songs and making music, but you get very little time to do that if you're a touring musician. So you know, I think a lot of musicians have had this experience, and and then so they don't want to connect through their management anymore. They've found other ways to sort of bypass that, even if they're, you know, well enough off to be living off the royalties. I've gone, what am I going to do with myself?
Especially since the management company folded a few years ago anyway, right?
You know,
when the management company folds anyway, and then you have to start managing yourself.
Yeah.
When the people that used to distribute your CDs stop distributing anybody's CDs because there's not enough money to be made in it, you're doing it yourself again.
But I guess we were lucky that we had to wear all the hats all along, because we're still wearing them, and it's possible. But we didn't have to do that learning curve. That's interesting.
That's all right.
I think it does make a difference to folks that have had to, you know, to just pull together whatever tiny resources they had and learn to make everything from the ground up. You know, it means that we have, and those
participated in that because we want you to be able to do it again.
Yeah. But those skills even, you know, go beyond music, you know. Can we make our own food? Can we grow our own food? Can we do all these things that we may well have to do for some amount of time here? Can we build our own things that need to be built? You know, those having and retaining those kinds of skills are I think really crucial.
Can we
as
run
we go
our
forward.
Own tech, or do we need tech support like Paula?
No, we will.
I think the answer is you can, but it's better to have.
Yeah, we will always need the community. That's the thing. And those of us, I think, who are clear about that and who create those networks, I think are the ones that will always get through somehow, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's true in poor neighborhoods all around the world.
Mm. You know? Oh, man, right? Absolutely. I've never seen so much mutual aid than in a neighborhood I lived in where most of the people were on welfare.
Yeah.
For sure.
Because right. It's interdependence. That's right. Survive. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Wow.
So well, great. Thank you guys so much. This has been such a pleasure. Let's plan a next discussion sometime down the road.
For it. Definitely. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much, y'all.
Thank you.
You too.
I'll see you next Sunday.
Okay, good. Right. Bye.
Good. Bye-bye. And this has been an episode of Song News Network Presents, and you can find it if you look for on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance and various other places, and in audio form if you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. Bye for now.